Welcome to the podcast of Grace Covenant Church, where we are transformed by God's grace, connected through relationships, and committed to service.
So today we're going to continue week 5 of 6 on marriage and rethinking marriage. This week, if you look in your outline, it's rather full, isn't it? And look at that title. That's endearing, isn't it? Burning Your Own House Down. Sharpen your pencil. We're going to go through this outline rather quickly. When I was in seminary, we, like a lot of people in school, they pick the teachers and then figure out what the subjects are later. And then the favorite teacher at our school was a gentleman that taught the theology classes, but he also taught marriage and family. And I think the reason everyone liked him so much was he was kind of just earthy. He was a little bit guttural. I don't know. He was efficient with his truth. I don't know how to say it. He just kind of laid it out there the way it was, and so you didn't have to try to negotiate what he meant. He just said what he meant. And so one day, in a marriage and family class, he just said, you know what, if any of you guys think that you won't trade a 30-year career and reputation for 10 minutes in bed with some girl, you're foolish. And we were like, well, I wouldn't trade that. Oh, yeah, you will. Any one of you would do that. You're stupid and naive to think you wouldn't. Well, that's what I'm talking. It's kind of earthy and out there. So we all took warning of that. Excuse me. And 5 years later, one of the guys in the class was touring America, giving talks on relationships to college students, big conferences, huge conferences, 5, 7, 10,000 students would go. He was very popular. And during one of those conferences, he found a girlfriend and ruined his marriage and lost his ministry. He didn't take the warning. He was the professor. He was the professor in the class that was telling us to be warned, to be nervous about our lifestyle, that anybody could fall. That year, I lost two heroes. I lost in two different generations that gentleman that I always looked up to and even still do, but he was just tragic of the decisions he made, and another pastor friend of mine that walked away from his wife and for 15 years, I think, and left her with three boys. And it was like, how does that happen? People that are so much more astute, I guess, or whatever they might be, you know they're better than you are, and yet they make bad decisions. Today we're going to look about how not to make bad decisions. You know, we're going to look at the four stages of adultery, and then we're going to stop, you know, right in the middle and say, okay, what are we going to do to keep from making those stupid choices? Because when the Bible talks about marriage, it talks about kindling a fire white hot with passion. It is not sheepish about how much you can enjoy marriage. But there's confines to that, right? Within your fireplace, right? Within the parameters of the brick and the glass front or the metal mesh front, that's for a purpose. That's for your protection, because if just one of those cinders jumps out of there and falls on your carpet or floor, it will burn your own house down. And today we're going to talk about how to keep from burning your own house down. This is not a talk to learn how to keep your mate from cheating, because you can't do anything to keep another person from doing anything. This is a talk that's going to go through Proverbs. We're just going to go through topically about how you can do something to make it harder for a person to ever want to leave you. This is going to inform you of the danger signs that you need to listen to so that you don't fall into these traps of a world of regret, and can learn from the book of Proverbs mostly on how to prevent it. The first stage, if you look this up, you can see there's four stages of adultery. The first stage is the coals go cold. And there are stages in our married life that are especially vulnerable to being sucker punched. You don't know it's coming. You had no idea how vulnerable you were, and you started making decisions and it kind of wandering off into a field that you had no business being in. Then you get lost when you're out there. When you're newly married, for example, that's for sure, because the roots of your marriage they're shallow. You don't know how real love is work and how much of a choice it is. It's not romantic. It's not lust. It is a choice, and it requires a lot of work. And sometimes you haven't even given up the software program that says you get to flirt with people, or you're still dating. And so some people wander off in that way. Another vulnerable time in marriage is when you have young children, because married life is just exhausting, especially if you have a number of little ones and you feel like you don't have time or energy to do anything positive. Now, you'll have energy to argue, you know, and you won't be able to fail, but just you cannot seem to invest in each other effectively. And then there's another stage that's especially vulnerable. It's parents of adolescents, because that time is sometimes just filled with grief and guilt. And there's a last attempts of trying to control another free moral agent. And so what happens sometimes when you have parents of adolescents is they want to go someplace else to just escape. I want an isle of refuge where things are simpler and there's not life and death decisions, and there's a place maybe I could win and not always lose. One of the other stages of marriage that's difficult is midlife. You know, the midlife crisis, right? I mean, how many times have you heard someone making decisions based on a midlife experience? And that's because there's the grasp of the reality that you will die and you will be forgotten. And when not everybody understands that, but when that hits, it is a painful and disorienting reality. Then there's the realization in midlife that you're not going to reach the goals that you had ever. Or even worse, you've reached the goals you had and they're not satisfying. And so there's a fog that takes over your life in midlife that you find yourself trying to be young again, trying to grasp at something that would keep you young because you realize you'll die. So all of that, I don't know if you noticed, but I think we covered all phases of life, didn't we? I don't know if you heard that, but it's actually all of our adult Sunday school class stage groups as well, because there's no safe place. And each part of life has these giant entrances into wandering off into the wilderness. You know, all the while, you know, you're going into that, you know, just floating on an ocean that has legalized selfishness. We are drowning in a culture of sensuality like no time in American history. It's been this way in other cultures and other parts of human history, but in our country, it has never been so sensual. And so, you know, I mean, you remember if you heard the song, Paula Cole's song, Where Have All the Cowboys Gone? And it's a fun, it's not, there's nothing fun about it, but it starts off fun and it's happy and it's working her way through these life stages. And the chorus goes something like, you know, I'll do all the laundry and you'll pay all the bills. And it's like, oh, think about all the fun we'll have in life. And then as she's going through life and marriage is getting more and more detrimental, you know, now she's, you know, with her teeth grit, yeah, I'll do the laundry, you pay the bills. It's a very difficult experience for us, and it's easy to make very life-altering decisions. It takes 30, 40 years to build a reputation. It takes 10 minutes to destroy it. James Dobson. He says the coals go cold because it's metaphorical, but he says it's like we have hormone deprivation, males and females, and our mate balances those hormones. The wife gives her husband respect and honor, and the husband gives her wife love and consistency and self-respect. And those two needs are being met by each other. They're voids that are filled. They're vacuums that are filled by our mates. And when the coals go cold, we know it. And we long for those voids to be filled somewhere. And then in comes the second stage of adultery, and that's a friendly flirt, where we see someone at work or in the neighborhood or out on the soccer fields or in the gym. And they're saying the things that we wish we heard at home. And they're giving us those hormones. Metaphorically speaking, they're giving us the respect that we would like or the love that we cherish so much. Someone is interested in us, you know? Someone thinks I'm worthy of not being distracted and being involved in a conversation. It's great to hear that I can be attractive to someone else. And those signals that we get from people are like what? I mean, a fresh, cold glass of water on a hot August afternoon. And we like it a lot. Meanwhile, right, okay, nothing's changed at home, and so we go back to a home that's void of these things, and you know, it's full of resentment and spite, and we're stingy with affection towards one another. And so it's feeling even worse at home than it did before this other person involves themselves. If you know someone, if you've ever been there, people will describe this infatuation part of their of this flirt as like something that's somewhat childish. They'll say, "I haven't felt this excited or alive since I was in high school." And they're, in some respects, they're telling the truth because it's high school love. It's infatuation. It's lust. It's shallow. It's not even real. And the person's getting to go back in time before they understood what real love was. And then they start going places they shouldn't go. One of the students at Dallas Theological Seminary did a dissertation by researching 250 pastors that had lost their ministries because they committed adultery. And he was looking for the one thing in common. And there was a lot of derivations, but the one thing that they did have in common is they all acknowledged that they were straying too close to the cliff, and they slipped off. Here's what I want you to hear up to, you know, stage two here, is that it's subtle. Right, that there's the coals are, you know, they're not hot at home, and then this other person comes into our lives, and it's just this gradual slip. But I also want you to hear this: that every one of these men that looked back and said, "I wrecked my life, and I know when, and it was when I went too far." A counselor that has a radio show in Colorado says this about I don't know how I got here. She said, "You can't say, I don't know how this happened. That's crock. You knew it when you had sweaty palms and sweaty pits. You knew it when there were long gazes back and forth at each other. You decided when you decided not to decide. That's when you knew." And then there's that sentence: "We've been trolling and fishing, and now we're trying to figure out if the nibble is actually going to take." And the relationship has progressed to the part where the hugs are kind of lingering and we're laughing a little too much at some conversations and jokes. And we're trying to identify whether or not the person has mutual feelings for us. And now it's very important because lust increases in desire, okay? Lust increases in desires but decreases in actual pleasure. It increases in desire. I want it more, I want it, but it decreases in actual pleasure. Once you get it, it doesn't satisfy, and you're gonna need more and more. And so at this stage, you're wanting more and more because it's increasing in desire. And so it's you can't just come out and say it or else you'll be called out. And so the conversations get a little bit eerie. It's like a little kid on the playground, a four-year-old child on the playground, and doesn't know who's going to play ball with them. And so they just kind of roll the ball. "Look, accidentally, I roll the ball over to you. No? Okay, I'll go get it, you know? And then over to someone else. And then somebody throws it back. "Oh, would you like to play ball today? Because I'm here at the park to play ball. Boy, I really enjoy being around you." You know, you say things that I sometimes wish my husband would say. "You know, it's so hard sometimes to go home because I enjoy being here so much." Just, you know, you roll that back and see where that goes. And then there's a commitment where someone says, "Hey, can I tell you something I've never told anyone? And I probably shouldn't tell you. Could you come a little closer?" And then all personal space is violated. And you should say, because this is what it means. When you get that close and then you say that sentence, you're really saying, "We're dead. It's over. How did we get here?" Like it says in Proverbs, "All at once, he followed her like an ox going to the slaughter, like a deer stepping into a noose." Because you have emotionally committed more it's so dark. The turnaround will give you whiplash. And so you say, hey, I've got a friend with a lake house. Or my, no one's home on Tuesdays. There's a hotel, whatever. And then you get found out because you always get found out. And then the non-offending mate goes crazy. They don't know what has happened. And whoever they are, they aren't. So a quiet little girl, you know, woman who is rather passive will punch and scratch and beat her husband. Or a man that's known for being meek and mild will show up at this other guy's place of work and throw a tantrum, not caring if the police show up. They're going to go temporarily insane. And the offending party, the unfaithful party, it has been addicted to the buzz of what is prohibited, right? And that's what's been kind of motivating this in many ways, is what is forbidden is desired. And so now that they've been found out, they panic like someone that's been caught, right, committing some great crime. And so they're trying to chase down old lies. They're being excessively defensive and elusive. They're acting crazy. It's the addiction that's speaking. And now they are prime to make decisions that are absolutely contrary to everything they have ever done in 42 years. You'll go play golf with them because the mate said, you've got to get together with my husband or wife, and you've got to spend some time with them. And by the third hole, you won't know who you're talking to, because something has taken over them. And if you don't believe in the devil that just enjoys ruining what God builds, what God builds in 40 years, he can tear down in just a few minutes. Here's the thing. It's a lie. The whole thing is a lie. It's not even real. The power was in the fact that it was pretend. It was never lust or love. It was lust. It was just passion for the forbidden. And that's what was being pursued, was what they could not have. And that's what made the sex so infatuating and what made it so memorable. And it was never real. And like I said, like lust, right? Lust is increasing in desire, but decreases in pleasure. And so once it's all been found out, and now it's somewhat legitimate, and so fine, it's like, well, it's not what I thought. If you want to rethink one thing, if you want to memorize one verse in the book of Proverbs, make it this verse. Stolen bread tastes sweet, but soon your mouth is full of gravel. That is the nature of a soul that's bent away from God. All of us have souls bent away from God. There is a fruit of the tree that you cannot eat. Really, which tree? I'll stand under that tree and gaze at it. How many trees are in the Garden of Eden? A billion. Which tree are we staring at? The one that's forbidden. Stolen bread tastes so sweet. Oh, if I could just have what I cannot have. And then no sooner do you eat it that your mouth has gravel. You're chipping your teeth on the gravel that you ate. And you traded your soul for Turkish delights. Just math. Let me give you math. Let science tell you how artificial this is. The two people that have cheated, there is only a 10% chance that they'll get married. 90% chance that the relationship's over within 2 years. 10% chance that they'll get married. Of the 10% that do get married, 75% will end in divorce. 75% of the 10% don't last. And you know why? Because real life is so much harsher than the fantasy of your high school fling being repeated when you're 33. another little fun statistic, some research done at one of the Colorado universities, 80% of people that get a divorce because of infidelity wish they would not have. 80% of the people that ended the marriage because of there was someone cheating wish they would have put their heads down and plowed a deep, truth-filled, loving restoration to bring it back together again. So what do you do? I mean, right? What are we going to do about this? What do you do to keep from being involved in affair? This is not a lesson to teach you how to help your mate keep from cheating, because you can't do anything about another human being's conduct, but you can do something about your own. And that's what we're talking about today, about your responsibility. And there's four, and then in one of them, there's a 4 points under one of those points. Okay, so the first one is be afraid. Be very afraid. 1 Corinthians 10 says this, right? You know, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he falls. I don't know about you, but everything that I think I'm remotely good at, whatever, men or women that are so much better that I know personally have cheated. Men that are smarter, men that are more godly, men that are far more disciplined, men that know more about marriage, family, intimacy. What you name the category, and they fell over the cliff that, what, I think I can't fall over? Be afraid. Be afraid. Now look what Proverbs says. Guard your heart, right? All else, guard your heart. It's the wellspring of your life. And how do you guard your heart when it comes to this issue? Be afraid. Billy Graham was asked by a young pastor in an interview. He said, you know, Dr. Graham, you've been preaching for 40 years. How have you maintained your purity? He said, here's the trick. I'm scared. I walk scared. Wherever I walk, I'm scared. That's how. Okay. Two, keep the home fire burning. Keep the home fire burning. Look what it says in Proverbs. You can look this up later. This is chapter 5, 15 and 18, but 5, 15 through 18 is great. Drink, right? Drink the water from your own cistern, right? Running water from your own well. That means it's fresh water. Verse 18 says, may the fountain of, may your fountain be blessed, and may you rejoice in the wife of your youth. There's so much more sensuality in obedience than there can ever be in disobedience. We'll talk some more about that tomorrow. But you have to do the things that ignite a fire, and you have to do the things that are fire extinguishers in your marriage. And fire extinguishers are these. Look, control. When you are controlling your mate, it makes your mate want to go somewhere else so they can be free. Where they can be themselves. The difference between a house and a home is a home is a place where you can be you. And as a mate, your job description is not to control, but to enjoy. And right, what follows is obvious for that is unforgiveness is a fire extinguisher. If you won't let someone make mistakes and recover from those, if you're going to keep bringing stuff up over and over again, a needy person kills the coals of passion in marriage, because you don't want to be another straw stuck in your mate's soul, sucking the life out of them. You want it to be givers in this marriage, not takers of that. Angry, disrespect, lack of transparency. Again, another major purpose of marriage is to live. You know what I mean? Existentially drink deeply in life. And you get to do that. That's why you are married. You said your vows to God so that you can feel and say things at a deeper level, and you're safe. There's plenty of places to be superficial and just talk about nothing forever. But your mate, they need more. And the things that kindle, right? The things that poke the fire and get it going, right? Conversation, affection, sex, companionship. A Colorado Christian counselor did a 40 years, you know, her 40 years in counseling said the other woman, the other man, the single greatest characteristic that they all had was they were good listeners. They were good. Listen, I listened to a prostitute being interviewed on a local radio show here in Austin on the way home one day. And so the guy was just going back and forth because he hadn't had a prostitute on the phone before or on the radio. And he said, hey, what is the deal? Why do guys hire you? And she said, you know what? You wouldn't believe this. Mostly to just talk. They just want somebody they can talk to. They want to be heard. And so that's what I do. I listen. At $250 an hour, yeah. Here's what you do. Here's the application for this whole thing. You save something for your mate. You save, let's just say energy. Let's call it relational energy, emotional energy, physical energy. You save 10% every day for the person you love the most. And here's how you do that. You know that life is trying to take all of that away from you. The kids, whatever it is, the kids, work, various things that are pulling on you, but you have to pace yourself. Let's just pretend, you know, for the sake of illustration here, that every day you get a gallon, right? You get a gallon of life. And the rest of the day is taking the life away. My encouragement here to keep this fire burning is when you get down to 10% left, you turn off all the caring switches. You have that button. I mean, we asked first hour, and people pretended that they didn't have a caring off button. And I have one. And when people come to me or things happen in life, I'll be going, oh, yeah, uh-huh. And inside I'm going, don't care. Don't care. Not even at all. I'm down to 10%. I'm saving the 10% for someone else, and you're not that person. So, oh, yeah, yeah. Tomorrow, I'm going to wake up, and I'm going to care about all that you're talking about. Right now, don't care. No. Mom, Billy wrote on my face with a Sharpie. Billy, come here. I've been looking for that Sharpie. Thanks. He'll have the Sharpie on his face tomorrow, right? You can care about that later. You're saving for your mate. Because what happens most often is life drains you, and then you take it out on the person that needs it the most, the person that you are uniquely able to care and give towards. Okay, fourth, and this is kind of elaborate. It's simple, but it's don't cross the line, right? Everyone crossed some line. Every one of them crossed the line. Don't cross the line. Part A of that is don't even get started. Don't start with the volleys back and forth. Don't glare and glance too long. Don't hold too tightly. Don't say things that are not appropriate. Don't look. It goes like this. The ladder of affection towards someone, don't get on the first rung. And so you don't say things in front of, you don't say something in private that you wouldn't say with your mate standing right there. I mean, I've said some things. And I've brought my mate over because I wanted to say something very kind to someone, and I didn't want them to misunderstand. Come over here. I want a witness to this. You're a lovely person, and God cares for you. Right, honey? Yes. But if my wife's not there, I'm not going to, hey, good. You had a good day today. Good. When you flirt, you are playing with fire. Look what Proverbs says about this. Look. It says, can a man scoop fire? Look how he's mocking. Can a man scoop fire into his lap or his clothing without being burned? Can a man walk on hot coals without his feet being scorched? So is he who sleeps with another man's wife. No one who touches her will go unpunished. When you flirt with someone, and gosh, it feels so good to be flirted with again. Oh, that felt so good to my, really? So you're the person that can scoop up coals with their bare hands and then have scars. Don't even start. Two, listen to your mate. Listen to your mate. What I mean here is, we talked about this last week, sometimes you're missing it. The member of the opposite sex is sending you signals and you're like, duh, huh? Your mate, when your mate steps in and he or she is not type of person that's jealous. Okay, it's not a jealous personality type. It's just a normal person. When your mate says, that person's flirting with you, you're making me jealous of that person, your mate is right. And you need to, whatever's going on there, stop it. The genders know the language of their gender. It's their native tongue. And so it might be foreign to you, but it's not to them. Third, tell your mate the moment something happens. The moment you get the twinge, when the moment somebody is volleying a little ball to you. My wife reads every single piece of mail I get. Every thank you note, everything. And there have been a few times where I say, hey, I think you need to read this one carefully. I want to make sure I understand what she's saying. Tell them right. And you can say something, by the way, to someone. You want to stop a volley back and forth? Thank you so much. I can't wait to tell my mate what you told me because they'll be very encouraged. Whoa. Okay, then. Take my ball and go somewhere else. Yes, you will. Fourth, be accountable. Be accountable to someone else. Tell someone right away. Your old girlfriend Facebook friends you from high school. First of all, you don't friend them back. And then you call someone and you say, hey, this is resurrecting stuff I don't want to know about. You tell another human being right away. It puts boundaries on the cliffs that you don't want to fall over. Now, all that is leading up to this. Because the coals have gotten somewhat cold in the first place, something else is going on. Somebody needs to initiate a conversation that's exceptionally delicate, okay? And as marriage has responsibilities, and one of the responsibilities is to handle frailty with gentleness. Somebody, one of you needs to say, I'm lonely. I'm lonely for you. I need to hear something from you that says I matter and that I'm attractive to you, or that that you respect what I believe. I'm just kind of laying my whole heart out there and saying I've got to get something. And you cannot pounce on that, because they will shrivel up if they get that spread out, and if ever they'll come back. And so you have to do what your vows were about and saying, you know what, I have made you this way, I think. I have some responsibility in your lostness. You know, the Dobson thing, you have hormone deprivation because I'm not sending you the respect or the love that I'm supposed to be giving you. That's what this is about. Okay, and listen, you know, the fourth thing is so great at this church. The fourth thing is, would you consider going to what we call here at Reengage? And Reengage is, you know, for 15, almost 20 years now, our church has been just really on the point of the spear on making marriages strong. And we have a fabulous pre-engagement and pre-marriage counseling, and then some marriage mentoring, and some things that have helped realign marriages, some of them in desperate trouble, some of them that are surviving adulterous experiences. Some of them are just needing tune-ups. We've been doing this for years. Well, what's happened is it's gotten too big for us, and now what we've figured out a way to keep it very personal and intimate, but also bring the quality to more people, and it's called Reengage. Many of our mentors in pre-engagement, pre-marriage counseling, and our marriage counselors are the mentors in Reengage. It starts tomorrow night. We have childcare. You could bring your whole home group for 12 weeks and go through it together. You're already connected with each other. You could just kind of walk through this level of intimacy and accountability together. It'd be a beautiful thing to experience. Now, listen, I'll tell you this, I'm advertising it shamelessly, obviously, right? But it's not just for you, but it's for your friends at work and on your block and everything else. You don't have to go to church here to go to Reengage. We just want people to experience the greatness of God in marriage. The marriage ministry here, let me make sure we all understand what we do here, because marriage is so emphasized. We're not out to make great marriages. We're out to make godly men and women. We are out to glorify God in our lifestyle, our choices, the way we view life in reality, because we believe the truths of the Bible. Marriage is a means of doing that. We are not using God to have a happy marriage. We are using marriage to understand the glory of God. And we're not trying to make you a better husband or a better wife. We're trying to make you a better man of God or a woman of God. And you wouldn't believe what happens when that takes root. That's what we do, and that's how we're trying to do that. Okay? And we want people to experience the fullness of their walk with God because they have a full and large marriage. Would you consider going to reengage? Let me just close by telling you just a kind of a fun little story that motivates me. I changed the reason I was living a few years ago, and it happened by accident. I've been to a number of funerals and participated in a few as well. And I was coming, and it's not uncommon for me to be driving home, and sometimes Melinda's in the car with me, and I'll say, "Boy, that woman's never going to remarry." And then this last year, I said it out loud to the widow. Right, I know. Take it back. And I couldn't. And she said, "Well, what does that mean?" I said, "Listen, right. Well, I know a lot of men, and I know your husband well, and you will never remarry because no man will love you like he loved you. And I know him. I know how he has felt about you. I've seen you together, and you will be lonely until you die. And you will be lonely for him, because you are one of the very few people in all of human history to have experienced what it's like to have a man who fears God and loves his wife. And so don't do anything but enjoy the grief, because you're lucky, you're fortunate." And she said, "Wow, you know, I felt that about him. I always have, and I feel blessed." And I said, "Yes, you are, and so you'll never be able to remarry." I'd love to leave it there, but I'm not that kind of person. On the way home, I'm fairly competitive, and so I was driving home, and I thought, I'm going to live for someone saying that to my wife on my funeral. I'm going to work things around and do things and become God's man so that while they're lowering my casket into the 6 feet of dirt, someone's whispering into her ear, "I know men. Right? And no one will ever love you like he loved you." And I'll be meeting Jesus, and he'll be saying, "Well done, my good and faithful servant," and my servant, and my wife will be thinking, "There'll be no one better in the whole world to love me like my husband loved me." It's a really demented way at looking at today's lesson. But if you share in my competitiveness, whatever works, okay? Whatever works. I pray that for you. I pray that for you. I will right now. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, it is our prayer at this church that people would so desire to be with you and like you and possessed by your Spirit that we would be such uniquely qualified to love our mate that we could not be replaced, that no one could love our husband or wife like we do, because we have lived the Spirit-filled, abundant life that your Son promised that we could have. And so we are grabbing on that with hands and teeth and holding on to that promise. You said, "I came that I might have life and have it abundantly." And I want to live that life. And I want to live that life in my marriage. Dear God, you give us that desire, and then help us negotiate these torrential waters of sensuality and selfishness and this bent away from you. Help us be godly men and women who worship you even in our marriage. In Jesus' name, amen.
For more information about Grace, visit our website at grace360.org.